Now, we'll return to the first part that we began examining after having surveyed the book as a whole, and that has to do with the doxology in 1:13. Now, the last time we began discussing what is called the manual of offerings in chapters 1 to 7 of Leviticus, although we indicated that that material did not contain all that is said about offerings in the Old Testament. The material is scattered in a number of places, but that's the basic manual of these offerings. And we indicated the main offerings up here. I'll erase this material here. Beginning with the burnt offering, which, by the way, was the most common offering done every morning and every evening, not by every worshiper, obviously. Who did it when is not clear. Every morning and every evening, and sometimes even more frequently on certain feast days, convocation times. So it's the most common offering. Now what we're doing with these offerings is, first of all, particularly in conjunction with the burnt offering, which is the first of the so-called bloody offerings, cereal, meal offering is non-bloody offering, is to trace the main steps of the offering, to find out the meaning of each of those main steps. And then beyond that, since many of these main steps are repeated in the bloody offerings, we'll look for the distinctive element in each of the other offerings, along with a distinctive element in the burnt offering to begin with. So we'll find the meaning of the basic steps and then the distinctive meaning of each of the offerings. So let me refresh your mind as to what we did with the burnt offering, which is a gift or tributary kind of offering. The first step was the selection of the animal, and we indicated that there were two emphases there. The kind of animal selected, both involve the kind, but the herd or the flock from which the animal was selected, domesticated animal, and then a perfect male, and we indicated something of the significance of that kind of selection, of that kind of stuff. And then we talked about the presentation of the animal at the door of a tent of meeting, that is to say, in the presence of God. This is saying to God, this animal is for you. I have brought it here at your command to accomplish your purposes. And the purpose stated there is that the offerer may be accepted before the Lord. Now that, of course, is the main thrust of all of these offerings. Acceptance before Yahweh. And then the offerer lays the hand on the head of the animal, all this forceful pressure. And the second element of purpose is indicated here, that it shall be accepted to make atonement for him. Whatever atonement may mean in terms of ransom, or wiping away sin, or covering sin, whatever the imagery may mean. And we indicated the possible meanings of that step. And then we looked at the fourth step. The offerer kills the animal, and we emphasized the element of personal involvement in all of this, so that there is a very close association between the offerer and the animal, so that in effect the offerer is saying, what happens to this animal happens to me, not in an absolute sense necessarily, although some believe in a fairly absolute sense. If you have substitution which requires equivalence, then it would be absolute. For example, when this animal dies, then I'm dying. As I indicated, I don't think the evidence is clear-cut in that regard. At least this animal, in effect, symbolizes me. So when I offer this animal to you, I'm offering myself to you, along with this animal. Not merely an animal, but myself with it. That's the personal involvement. And then the priests present the blood, and we talked about the significance of the blood. We did that at the close of the hour. The evidence that life has been taken, because life is in the blood, in other words, there has been this sacrifice of life that God commanded, the evidence that a particular life has been, let me put that in with it. Has been taken. The life is important, not the blood as such, and indeed the particular life. Not just a life, but this particular life. So this is the blood of this particular animal, which means the life of this particular animal. And evidence that the offering has been made in accordance with the purposes and stipulations of God. That's implied in this, so that it isn't really blood, or even blood of a particular animal, but blood of a particular animal, that is to say, the life of a particular animal given for the purposes that God has indicated here, as we have already suggested those purposes. And then we made the comparison between this and the use of Jesus' blood in the New Testament, which is based on this Levitical element. And I trust that what we said was clear to you with regard to the fact that in the case of Jesus, too, his blood is not merely blood per se, certainly not merely human blood, but the blood of Jesus, a particular person who has lived a particular kind of life, and the blood represents something larger in view of the fact that it represents life, not merely death, but a death of a particular kind for certain reasons, issuing from a certain kind of life, which indicates the use of a part for a whole in Scripture. And very often, because we don't realize that, we misinterpret what the part means, such as was true of that preacher whom I mentioned, who insisted that Jesus' blood has to be chemically unique in order to justify, otherwise any blood would justify. That fails to see that blood is simply a part that represents a larger whole. Not only the whole of Jesus' death, with all that that means, but death in the context of his whole life. And we don't want to get into the atonement, New Testament atonement here, in any elaborate way. We're moving now to present historical significance, you see, in this. But let me say this, that one of our problems with regard to understanding New Testament atonement is that we tend to isolate the blood and the death of Christ from the rest of the context in which that has happened. And so we talk only in terms of atoning death, as if the death itself, isolated from everything else, provides atonement. That's not true. Any more than the mere killing of the animal here provides atonement. So you have a lot more here. What kind of animal it is, where it was selected from, what it means, the whole process of presentation, offering to God, laying hands, you see, the whole process is involved here. So in relation to Christ, I think we have to take the totality of what Christ means, and the death of Christ in that context, the blood of Christ in that context, to understand what's meant by the emphasis on Jesus' blood in the New Testament. Well, we'll be coming back to this later on, because we'll focus eventually on the present historical significance of all this, but I have to call your attention to this in order to get us thinking along that line, and because we might not have a chance to return to this particular element. And then the fifth step is that the offerer prepares the animal for burning, and here again you have personal involvement. He skins the animal and cuts it into pieces, flays it. The next step is that the priest prepares the fire and lays the pieces on the fire, and the whole animal is burned. Now that's the distinctive step in the burnt or whole offering, that the entire animal is burned. That's not quite absolute. For example, the skin is not burned, but for all intents and purposes, the whole animal is burned. And none is kept for the offerer, for example, over against, say, the peace offering, to which we'll come here in a few moments, and essentially none is kept for the priest. All of it is offered to God. Now, this distinctive step in the whole or burnt offering, I think, indicates its essential meaning, and that is total self-surrender on the part of the offerer to God. I keep nothing of myself for myself, just as I keep nothing of this animal for me. I now give myself, as symbolized by this animal, totally to you. So it's complete self-surrender and self-dedication to God that is involved in this offering. As the hymn puts it, take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee. Take myself, and I will be ever only all for thee. That's what this is saying. And perhaps, now moving to the new covenant, perhaps this is what Paul had in mind. I say perhaps because there's a difference of opinion. But perhaps Paul had this in mind when he said in Romans 12, 1 and 2, to the Roman church, present your bodies as a living sacrifice, That's all of you, because all that you do through your body on this earth. So when you present your body, you present your life, the totality of your life. Present your total life to God, which is your spiritual worship. Now, this is the spiritual counterpart in the New Testament. And of course, what happens in the New Testament is that that total self-surrender of the self is ultimately divorced from sacrificing the animal. You can sacrifice yourself without sacrificing an animal to symbolize the sacrifice of self in the New Testament. But the sacrifice of self is really the meaning of this offering. And I emphasize again that these offerings were intended to have spiritual meanings, and they were not done properly unless they had those spiritual meanings of them. In other words, if the offerer was saying, you know, all the while he was giving this offering, including burning the whole offering before God, there are certain lives that I want to reserve to myself, parts of my life that I want to reserve to myself, then of course the offering did not have the meaning it should have. And indeed what happened in the prophetic era was that there had developed such a divorce between the rituals and their spiritual meaning. The prophets went as far as to say, quit doing the rituals. God wants obedience rather than sacrifice, because there had been this dichotomy, bifurcation, between the rituals, which are symbols of a meaning. The reality is not the ritual. The reality is the meaning which they symbolize. And when the reality of the meaning was lost, and the symbols had no purpose, indeed were deceptive, were misleading, and resulted in a false and empty ritualism, which of course could cause the people to think they were obeying God and experiencing atonement and worship when they were not. Okay, any questions on this now, as to how we arrived at what we arrived at in this? All right, let's move now to the cereal offering, because not only does the meal or cereal offering follow the burnt offering in the text, but it followed the burnt offering in actual practice. That is to say, whenever you made a burnt offering, you followed it by a cereal offering. Now, the cereal offering was used at other times as well for special purposes, but it was used in this connection. Let me indicate here visually this distinctive meaning of the burnt offering. We'll come back to the meanings of these two offerings, along with the other offerings, in effect, in just a moment. I'll hold off what we have on the rest of this for just a moment. But let's move to the cereal offering now. And the cereal offering, again, is a tributary offering, or a gift offering. And it consisted mainly, and by the way, the Hebrew word mincha means literally a gift or a present or a tribute. So here again, something is given to God. It consisted mainly of flour and oil. In other words, it was an indication of the produce of the people, along with the labor that they engaged in order to make possible this produce. In other words, the emphasis here in the meal and cereal offering is not on myself or my life, but what I have and what I have done. See? In other words, my possessions. See? Now, the passage in 2 indicates that the meal or cereal offering could be either uncooked or cooked. And if cooked, there are three ways indicated as to how it could be cooked. And it's interesting how you have flexibility in these offerings, as we have emphasized previously. And in fact, let me indicate something which is very, very significant along these lines of flexibility. This comes up in connection with the sin offering in 4 and 5. You'll find in 5:11 following, and you find this emphasis several times in the sin offering, and it's implied even when it's not expressed. But if he cannot afford, which here is an adaptation in terms of what people are able to afford economically, but if he cannot afford even 2 turtle doves or 2 pigeons. Now, as I say, the pigeons were ubiquitous, not very expensive, you know, loss of fine demand, pretty common. But even if you cannot afford those, Then he shall bring for his offering for the sin which he has committed a tenth of an ephah of fine flour for a sin offering. That's interesting now. In other words, what amounts to a cereal offering can be brought for what is ordinarily a bloody offering for a sin offering, if one cannot afford an animal for the bloody sacrifice. Now, put that on for size with regard to substitution. Note, the flour was not killed. Flour of death, and then off with the flour. It's flour without death. Interesting. Very interesting. Let's put that into the computer and let that work around a bit. Particularly since, as you shall see, the sin or purification offering is expiatory. It deals primarily with the whole matter of making atonement for sin. That's the major element there. Now, that's included here, as we saw, too, but not the major element. The major element there. And yet you have the possibility of doing the expiatory offering without death. Very, very interesting. Okay, now let's return to the cereal offering. So it's used in other cases, that I'm pointing out in a very interesting way in the sin offering. It's prepared by the offerer and presented to the priest, and some is eaten by the priest in the sanctuary. You have here in these offerings provisions for the priesthood. After all, they have to be provided for, sustained. They could do the usual work that other people did, so you have means of sustaining them, and this is one means they share in some of these offerings. Indicate the occasions here. Always follow the burnt offering, sometimes at other times, such as the first fruits at harvest festival, Feast of Weeks, which is a harvest festival. Now, there were certain things added to the cereal, oil and incense, which apparently were designed to make the offering richer and more desirable. This relates to the purpose that we stated here, namely, what is pleasing, a pleasing odor to God, or what is pleasing to God. This is a more pleasing, more rich, more desirable kind of offering. And sometimes salt was added. And in 2:13, you have the expression used, the salt of the covenant. And by the way, you have a pleasing order emphasized in 12. Then you shall season all your cereal offerings with salt. You shall not let the salt of the covenant with your God be lacking from your cereal offering. Now, salt had to do, again, with making something pleasing. It may have gotten beyond that in terms of its significance, but it's a very significant element here. The expression that was used was, share your salt. So it indicates a covenant relationship with this God, with whom you share this salted offering, cereal offering. Then there was a prohibition, and that is that it ought not to be leavened, and honey ought not to be added. Now, you might think, well, I'd like to have some honey added. Fine. But apparently God did not want the honey added. And the reason why he did not want the honey added is probably that honey served the same function as leaven, that is to say, it would cause fermentation. So this offering was to be unfermented, perhaps indicating symbolically that it was not corrupted, perhaps.
I don't know if this is going to apply back then, but I read something about you really shouldn't feed babies honey because honey has an awful lot of bacteria, and so it could create botulism, so it's really not a sure substance.
That so bacteria may have been related to fermentation. Again, I indicate to you what I did at the beginning of the discussion of Leviticus, and that is the meanings of some of these things have been lost in antiquity. So I notice how I qualify these things, perhaps. Maybe that's a valid point of view. I don't know. You do have the element in some of these rituals, the hygienic element, concern for hygiene, some of these. Whether that was involved or not, I don't know. I have some questions because this was not eaten by the offerer. Now, part of it might have been eaten by the priest, so there might have been concern. That's the kind of thing you have to think through. And in some cases, when you've gotten all the others you can get, you have to say, either I don't know what it means, or perhaps it means this, but I'm not sure what it means. Yeah.
Sometimes salt and
Yes. Well, that's questionable. That's questionable in light of what you have in the rest of the passage. The question is, does this apply to all of these forms of the offerings? So you have the offering in various forms, and then you have it mentioned elsewhere without salt. So that's why sometimes about it. But here again, the evidence with regard to these offerings is not clear. It doesn't all hang together. So you have to indicate at times that you're not sure as to exactly what the evidence is with regard to the congruity and all these things. So it's on the basis of all the evidence we have that perhaps it's not done always. Okay, now the meaning and the purpose, and here is the distinctive element, I use the asterisk to indicate the distinctive element, has to do with the emphasis on a memorial, which is a means of remembrance, and we need to remember what remembrance is in Old Testament terms. Remembrance, of course, has to do not only with recalling something, but with appropriating it, implementing it, acting on the basis of it. What's being remembered here? What's being remembered are several things. One, their dependence upon God for this produce. The offerer is saying, you have given this to me. I depend upon you for my food. Even though I have worked for it, my work could not produce it except with your help. I am grateful for what you have done for me. Now, by the way, this dependence means that unless they continue to be in a proper covenant relationship with God, they will not have their products. I am grateful for what you have done for me, involves the element of gratitude along with dependence, and it involves an offering, now a gift to God, of income, labor, material possessions. So it's not only a matter of total self-surrender to God, but a total surrender of one's possessions and the labor which produces these possessions to God, which is the distinctive element in this offering. Now, these two things go hand in hand. Not either or, but both and. It's certainly not, here are some of my things, but I'm going to reserve my life for myself. Or, here is my life, here am I, take me, but I'm going to use my things for myself. By the way, those are the great dichotomies with which we work in the present, aren't they? We tend to separate these things, one way or the other. So what these two offerings are saying is, it's not either or, it's both and. God requires. And perhaps that's why the burnt offering was always followed by the cereal offering. And the cereal offering always followed the burnt offering. They're closely associated in meaning and significance. Right?
But there's no atonement involved in
this
particular offering, is there?
No, there's no atonement. No atonement. There's no expiatory element in it. Except that it's used in that exceptional case.
With all these offerings taking place, how did they handle such a load? Were people expected to do these offerings every time they committed a sin?
We don't know how often they did it. No. We know that they did some of these offerings on special occasions, for example, in relation to vows or some special event in life, etc. We know they were offered at certain times communally, but we don't know how often each individual was involved. Obviously, it couldn't be very often. Otherwise, you'd decimate your flock and herd. You know, it'd all be ashes over there, and you'd have nothing to eat. So it could not be very often.
This was all done at the tent of meeting?
Yes. These offerings that are mentioned here were done basically at the tent of meeting. Now, certain things happen subsequently that make that difficult, especially when the people scattered. So there may have been other possibilities then, but here they're basically done at the tent of meeting.
There's over a million people. I'm trying to figure out at this small tent of meeting how to do it.
Yeah, it would have to be very selective. And one of the reasons for the Day of Atonement in chapter 16 is that the high priest represents all the people. So there's that representative element that takes care of many, many things in addition to these individual sacrifices that are made.
then Ray's question, what about verse 4? To be accepted and make it home. Didn't he ask 1-4?
No, he was talking, we're talking about the cereal offering here, Robert, not the burnt offering. No, you're talking about the cereal offering, right?
Thank you. And then, is there a difference between the tabernacle and the tent of meeting?
No, not here. The tent of meeting is the tabernacle here. There was a tent of meeting before the tabernacle was constructed in Exodus. But once the tabernacle is constructed, the tent of meeting is the tabernacle. Yes, John?
Is it probable, considering God supplied the manna in Exodus, where's the beef chapter numbers? Is it a big sacrifice for the people? I mean, is it probable that there weren't many cattle and that there wasn't a lot of flour since God was supplying the manna as well? It would be a great sacrifice on their part?
At this stage. That's why I said initially there wasn't much meat available. So you're talking about a very, very costly sacrifice at this stage. Now, of course, these were designed for the life of Israel in Canaan as well, when there would be more cattle and more produce. But at this stage, it involved a particular sacrificial kind of act. Okay, let's move then to the next offering, namely the peace offering. This is a communal offering. Remember we indicated three types, gift, tributary, the communion kind of offering, and then the expiatory kind of offering. This is a communion kind of offering, the peace offering, and it was optional. And in this case, you had, in some instances, less than perfect animals offered. And also, by the way, females, were against the male without blemish. So there's a change here with regard to the kind of animal that's offered. Now, let's talk about the peace offering. The situations when the peace offering was made was in conjunction with confession. And you note we pick up passages from other places. But as I say, these offerings are described in various places. So you have confession offering in relation to sin. You have this made in relation to vows. 1 Samuel. Not Isaiah, that's 1 Samuel 1:24, in conjunction with the birth of Samuel, as a result of a vow that Hannah made with regard to the offering of her son, if he was given by God. And then it's a freewill offering at times. In Exodus 35:29, you have an instance of that kind of offering. So it's done on various occasions. Basically, the steps of the whole or burnt offering are used. Basically. So that those steps, in this case, have essentially the same significance as they would have in the case of the burnt offering. The distinctive step is instead of burning the entire animal, after the best parts are offered to God, and by the way, fatty parts are considered the best parts. I don't know about you, but I like fat. It tastes good. I can't eat it, but I like it. Too much cholesterol and triglycerides. It's good. So the best parts are offered to God. The rest was eaten as a sacral meal by the offerer and the family, with God serving as the host. Now, we must realize that the implication is that this animal belongs to God. It's God's. So that when God says to the worshiper, you eat part of it, he is the host at a meal. He is providing the food, even though the offerer, of course, has offered the animal, but it belongs to God. So he is providing the food. He's sharing the food with the offer. It was a very joyous occasion. The name comes from shalom, peace. That indicates well-being, harmony, reconciliation with God. And by the way, the clue to the distinctive step here is found not in chapter 3, where the main offering is discussed, but rather in 7:15. Flesh of the sacrifice of his peace offering for thanksgiving shall be eaten on the day of his offering. He shall not leave any of it until the morning, but if the sacrifice of his offering, the votive offering, or freewill offering, shall be eaten on the day that he offers the sacrifice, on the morrow what remains of it shall be eaten, etc. So this indicates the eating of part of the sacrifice by the offerer. Now, as you know, when you invite someone to a meal, that indicates friendship, fellowship, harmony. In fact, companion literally means to eat bread with someone. They're my companion. And as you know, you tend to invite your friends to meals. Maybe you ought to invite more of our enemies to meals. But anyway, our tendency is to invite friends to meals. So that the whole emphasis here is one of reconciliation. God says, sit down and eat a meal with me, which I provide with you. It's a sacral meal. And that's why the emphasis is on communion, say. Reconciliation. Very, very important to mention in all of these. Offering really in terms of what they're offered for. Any questions on that? All right, let's look then at the next bloody offering, namely the sin or purification offering. And there is some difference of opinion as to what's involved here. Wenham, for example, in the NIC series, thinks that the use of the Hebrew Chata means to wash away. So it's an offering that washes sin away, purification offering. Perhaps that's the imagery. I'm not completely convinced of that. In any case, it has to do with sin, and it has to do with unwitting sin. That's the great emphasis in 5 and 6, although there is a question, in 4 and 5, although there's a question as to whether the material at the end of 5 describes the same offering. Here again, we're getting into some of these ambiguities because it uses guilt offering language, which is often associated with this last offering. That's often called the guilt offering. But in any case, the emphasis is on unwitting sin, and you find that immediately in chapter 4, the Lord said to Moses, say to the people of Israel, if anyone sins unwittingly in any of the things which the Lord has commanded not to be done, and does any of them, and then it goes on to indicate the various ones for whom the offering is made. Now, the offering apparently was made when the person came to realize that a sin had been committed. It was not offered regularly on the basis that I must have committed an unwitting sin sometime, so here's an offering, Lord. It was offered when the sin became known, when the person sensed guilt. And by the way, it had to do with both acts of omission and acts of commission. Either not doing what God wanted done, or doing things that God did not want done. Including, by the way, a slip of a memory, which, incidentally, particularly when people start getting my age, would not be uncommon in view of all the rules and regulations you had. They didn't have computers in those days, so you couldn't put all the rules and regulations on the screen, you know. You had to try to remember them, and there would be occasions when there would be a slip of the memory, or simply an oversight, not being aware that something is not in accordance with God's will. Now, the offering was made for all. It's a compulsory offering, by the way. And four groups are discussed in the passage. The anointed priests, so the priests are involved as well, as is true in all this. The priests are treated like the people in all this, right? They have to have offerings made for them. You saw that in the Day of Atonement, where the high priest had to have offerings, make offerings on behalf of himself first. The whole congregation, ruler, and one of the common people. Now, incidentally, here is a social dimension, a communal dimension, the whole congregation. When perhaps they did something, the whole people did something, which unwittingly, which violated God's command, or perhaps it was representative on behalf of individuals of the entire nation. We've already indicated this, for unwitting sin, both omission and commission, when that sin is discovered. Now, what is distinctive in this offering is the use of the blood. Let's look at that, at least one description of it, and it recurs with regard to the offering for these various parties. In 4:6, the priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle part of the blood seven times before the Lord in front of the veil of the sanctuary. And the priest shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar of fragrant incense before the Lord, which is in the tent of meeting, in other words, in front of the veil of the sanctuary, but also inside the sanctuary, and on the altar of incense, which is immediately in front of the Holy of Holies. So that's getting very close to God, isn't it? So where the blood is sprinkled, and the fact that it's sprinkled not only on the altar of fragrant incense, but on his horns, which are the most prominent part of it, but also near the Holy of Holies, very close to God, indicates the prominence of blood here. Now, for example, here the blood was sprinkled or was poured in relation to the altar of burnt offering, way out in the court, you see. So this is getting much closer, seven times, indicating the prominence of it. So what is prominent then is the use of the blood, and that's why this offering is expiatory. This has to do with the use of the blood in connection with the atonement in order to make reparations for sin. Now, we ought to indicate something else as well, because here apparently, at least it's my understanding, that the laying of hands on the animal does suggest a transfer of sin to the animal, symbolically. And what happens then, because the animal is contaminated by sin, is that instead of the animals being burnt here, at the altar of burnt offering, as it was here, at least the part that was not eaten by the offerer, what you have here is the carcass of the animal is taken outside the camp, for the most part, and burned there, away from the presence of God. Indicating, of course, the fact that a holy God has difficulty reckoning with sin, abiding with sin. So you have to take it away from the abiding place, the dwelling place of God, outside the camp. So that that's another dimension that is significant here. Now, let's look at the... any questions on these? We're going rapidly because our time is limited. Let's look at the final offering here. It's called by various names, as we've indicated up there, trespass, guilt, reparation, sometimes called sin offering. This, too, is expiatory. The difference between this offering and the offering in 4 and 5, if indeed the end of 5 describes the sin offering, is that this offering has to do with known sin. Note at the beginning of the chapter, chapter 6, and by the way, it's 6:1 to 7 that really describes this burnt offering, I mean this trespass offering. If anyone sins and commits a breach of faith against the Lord by deceiving his neighbor in a matter of deposit or security, or through robbery, or if he has oppressed his neighbor, or has found what was lost and lied about it, swearing falsely, etc. So you're talking about known sin. No, you don't go out and rob somebody not knowing that you're doing something wrong. That's very much on your mind, I would think. And you know that God said, thou shalt not steal. So you're talking here not about unwitting sin, but about known sin, deliberate sin. Now, let me just add very quickly here that the distinctive element here, although the basic steps of the sin offering are followed, has to do with restitution. Which involves restoration. But restitution, which goes beyond what you have at the end of chapter 5, because what you do here is not only to restore in full what you have taken from your neighbor, but you add 20% to it. You give the person even more than you took, by way of indicating your responsibility toward that person and your recognition that you have done something wrong to that person. And indeed, when you've done something wrong to that person, a member of the covenant people, you've done something wrong to God. And you see how this ties God up with human beings, and human beings up with God. So it's not a matter of thinking only in terms of what you do directly to God, but what you do to anyone with whom God is implicated, and about whom God cares, namely the covenant people. So restitution is the significant element here in this offering. This offering is also expiatory. Expiatory offering, that's the main thrust. In other words, it's not enough to offer the animal. You need also to restore what you've taken from your neighbor in order to make atonement for sin. Okay. Let's see. You've gotten your papers back, have you? On 1 to 7. Okay, so hold on to those and use them. Next time, we'll move towards synthesis. And we'll focus on synthesizing these offerings, but what we say about these offerings really synthesizes the book as a whole, from the major thrust of all of these rituals. So that's what we'll focus on next time. Thank you. We'll see you tomorrow then. I think that indicates for you that Jesus denied sin offering. And we need to share this kind of credit, but in terms of Now discuss the major offerings that are found in the manual of offering in Leviticus 1 to 7. And we tried to indicate the meaning of the main steps of the offerings. We focused particularly on the burnt offering in that connection. We tried to pick up the distinctive meaning of each of the offerings. And now we want to move to some synthesis, unless you have any further questions on the offerings. No, I don't think there's a direct connection, except that there's a similarity between the unleavened bread of the Passover and unleavened bread festival and the unleavening here. No. Not that I know of. Yes? No.
Considering that mostly all they had in the wilderness was manna, how did they do a cereal offering that killed the child?
That's a good question. I'm not sure what the answer is. As I say, these offerings were designed for the long run. And so I suppose they did what they did, could do in the wilderness. But the emphasis was on what they would do in the land of Canaan, obviously, because that involved the long run. And as you discover, there is great flexibility here. So I'm sure that God didn't expect them to do what they couldn't do. But I don't know exactly what they did. The wilderness experience. Any other questions, comments? All right, we want to move now to synthesis, and we're going to focus on the synthesis of the offerings, but in the process we'll really pick up the synthesis of the whole Levitical cult, because what you find elsewhere, including in the Hebrew religious calendar, is simply more of the same. In fact, many of these offerings were used at the various festivals. And some of the festivals, for example, the Festival of Weeks, which probably was a festival related to produce, is quite similar in its focus on the cereal offering. So that there is a lot of correlation between the festivals and these various offerings. So in the process, we'll be synthesizing the whole Levitical cult. And we'll do so, as we suggest you do so in your papers, topically. And we'll focus on three areas. What does it say about God? What does it say about sin? And what does it say about atonement and worship? We have three topics up here. And we pick up these topics not arbitrarily, but because we found that these are the emphases in the offerings themselves. So that's why we use this particular approach. And then we'll use another approach with regard to the book as a whole, and that is to define a key word in the book as a whole, namely holiness, by way of synthesis, pulling together these various emphases. Let's begin then with the matter of the theology proper of the book of Leviticus, and let me ask you to volunteer as to what emphases, to begin with, about God are found in these offerings and throughout the cult. Anyone? John? All right, very, very important that he is a forgiving God, which means he, what kind of God? What does it say about him?
Merciful.
Gracious, loving, he is concerned about the well-being of his people, about the redemption of his people, which is the essence of love, is over against their destruction. He cares about the covenant relationship, wants that covenant relationship to continue, so provides in advance for violations of the covenant relationship in order that the covenant relationship may continue in spite of sin. And indeed, I would say that this is the great emphasis of Leviticus, not the wrath of God. You don't get a feeling that God is an angry God in Leviticus, do you? Except for Leviticus 10, when the cult was violated. The feeling you get is that this God, who knows sin is going to happen, who abhors it, and we need to add to this, of course, a holy God, who abhors sin. He doesn't take sin lightly. So he abhors it, and yet at the same time, he provides for it in advance, which I think is very, very significant with regard to this Levitical cult. Yes, Robert, yes.
I was thinking before that, you mentioned
that. Very good. The imminence of God is involved in all of this. And along with the imminence of God, his transcendence. You have both elements, as we indicated when we talked about the tabernacle, the tabernacle furniture. You have both involved, but there's a great stress on the imminence of God. He's a God who dwells in the midst of the people, who goes before them. And not a God who is aloof or distant, although he transcends them as well as lives among them. Both very, very significant elements. What else is said about God here? Yes. All right, how can we capture that in some way? All right, can we say he's realistic?
Yeah.
And indeed flexible? Found in relation to the offerings, we're just talking about it here, he doesn't expect them to do what they can't do. And his realism extends, of course, to what we were talking about here, namely his realization that they will sin. He's not some kind of abstract idealist who says, in fact, well, these people don't need to sin, so they're not going to sin, or they shouldn't sin. No, he says, I'm facing the realities here. They will sin, and I'm going to deal realistically with their sin. In terms of expectations, in terms of procedures. So this You don't have rigidity here with regard to God. You have this this kind of realism, this kind of flexibility, which is very, very significant here. Like,
and yet you have, he's a God who has a standard of truth.
All right. That really relates to this matter of holiness, doesn't it? He doesn't sacrifice what he is. He doesn't sacrifice his hatred for sin. And so in the process, he maintains standards while doing so, however, as we said, flexibly. And by the way, of course, you have in that connection to a sovereign God. Now, to be sure, he is flexible, but he, when he's worked out his means of atonement and worship, of course, the first thing you get here is that all of this is divinely ordained. As we saw in the survey of the book as a whole, designed by God, not by the people. Once he set his standards, then they must be lived by. And so we find that story, which we've alluded several times in Leviticus 10, when the sons of Aaron bring this unholy fire, this strange fire before the Lord, and are killed as a result of it. So so you have this this standard and this sovereignty. He's not to be taken lightly. He is to be obeyed in every detail, once he's laid out that detail, although that detail is realistic and flexible. Yes?
Number one, that he takes pleasure.
All right, very good. We might describe that in theological words as a passable God, a God who can experience pleasure. These offerings were a pleasant odor unto the Lord, so that what the people do can bring joy, can bring joy to God. And of course, the opposite is true. If they don't do what he wants, then the joy is absent. So God's pleasure depends, at least in part, on what his people do. You don't have a God who is aloof and who is almost stoical, you know. It doesn't make any difference what you do down there. No, he's a God who's who responds to persons. And by the way, of course, behind all of this is a personal kind of God. He's a personal being. Because what we're describing here are personal qualities. We talked about passibility. We're talking about qualities similar to those that you and I have. What other people do can bring us joy or pain. God is the same way. God's heart can be broken. And his people broke his heart frequently. So that's a very, very important element here, theologically. Right?
And that seems to lead to relationship.
Very good. He's a relational God. He is concerned about interpersonal relations with his people. And the reason why he finds pleasure in his people, or his people bring him sadness, is because he values them. He values their relationship. In other words, this is another way of saying he's a God of the covenant, because the covenant is relational. He's a God who wants a covenant relationship with his people. And it's in order to maintain that relationship that these rituals are set up. And indeed, the rituals and the whole Hebrew calendar is a way of reminding the people constantly that God has made a covenant with them and wants a covenant relationship with them. That's the basic and underlying element in all of this. Anything else? Robert? That's involved in this whole initiative of God, his sovereignty. He is not controlled by humans. He determines his own approach, his own destiny. That's the meaning of sovereignty, isn't it? So he can't be manipulated by other people. He can't be talked out of what he's done. Everything that happens is done within the framework of what he himself has ordained. Any other shit? Like,
this probably comes under eminence, but he's a God who reveals himself constantly to man.
Right, he's a revelatory God. And this whole system is a system of revelation. As a matter of fact, when you look at the system, you find two things involved in it. It reveals a theology, a certain kind of God. That's what we're talking about here. You see, this kind of God is revealed through this system. So it develops a theology of atonement and of worship and appeals to the cognitive. They understand God better as a result of this entire system. It also, however, provides experiential and affective and behavioral elements as well. In other words, an experience of atonement and worship. So it appeals both to the mind so that they understand God better as a result of this revelation, but also it provides an experience which affects the total personality. So these are the two major dimensions involved in the rituals of Leviticus. Okay, very good. Any other elements? John?
I'm not sure if it's similar or not. Maybe in provisional gods, something for the portion that's given to Aaron and his sons.
Sorry, this I think we need to hold this down here temporarily. I'm sorry, I didn't get the first word.
Provisional, just in the offerings where a memorial portion is given to God and the rest of the earth is given to Aaron and his son.
All right, I suppose what we can use is a broader term, and that is a providential God. He's a God who provides for his people. That's involved in the cereal offering, that's involved in your harvest offerings and harvest festivals, etc., that God is the provider for the people. That's involved in the table of shortbread, probably, as we interpreted it. So this is a very, very important emphasis with regard to God and his relationship to the people. All right, let me round this out very quickly because we need to move on. He is also worthy of worship. That's obvious in all of this. And he is also a faithful God. He's a dependable God, a reliable God. In fact, in all of these offerings, the basic emphasis is on faith. That's one of the elements in atonement and worship, that God has stipulated certain things that need to be followed in order to experience atonement, for example. And when the people do that, he provides atonement, and the people trust him to do what he says he will do. Otherwise, of course, they wouldn't bring these valuable sacrifices and kill them and lose their animals unless they trusted God when he said, if you do this, you will be accepted before me. Atonement will be made for your sin. So the emphasis is on a reliable God, which, of course, is very, very basic to the covenant relationship. And then he's an ethical God. And he's concerned about sin, holiness. He's concerned about the sin of the people. And he himself is the kind of God who engages in behavior that's befitting of the God of Israel, the God of the covenant. Well, we could go on and on here, but you see what a full-blown theology there is in these rituals. They're not merely ancient rigmaroles through which the people went, but they really conveyed a theology which is very, very important from the standpoint of the understanding of the people. Okay, let's move now to the matter of sin. And let me get started for us here. One of the things that's emphasized about sin is the reality of sin. Indeed, it is symbolized by things, by stains, by dirt, something that needs to be cleaned. And of course, there's nothing more real to us than things. Think of reality, we tend to think of this. This is reality. This is a thing. But we must remember, by way of understanding this, particularly in its New Testament usage, we may move over to the New Testament in just a moment, that the thing is the symbol and not the reality. The reality of this sin is real. The reality of this sin is spiritual and interpersonal, not substantialistic. Now, I say that because we often tend to think of sin as a thing, something. And what we're doing is going back to Levitical language and indeed misunderstanding it. So, for example, some doctrines of entire sanctification are based on the concept that something is cleansed or eradicated from human personality. There is something inside of us that needs to be taken out. And entire sanctification does that. But sin is not a thing. Sin is interpersonal. It's a relationship. It's relational. It's spiritual. Although it is real. You tend to think of the spiritual as unreal, you know, because it's intangible. It's spiritual, interpersonal, relational, but real nonetheless. Very real. And very serious. The seriousness of sin is emphasized here. Those who had to sacrifice their best animals would have it impressed on their minds when they did that. This thing that I have done is serious. It's costly. It's not to be taken lightly. We've emphasized that with regard to God, His holiness, and His ethical character. So the seriousness of sin is underlined by all this. Now let me ask you here to volunteer some things. What else is said about sin? Yes. All right. It abrogates. You're talking about men first. Against whom is sin primarily directed?
God. Also, in a sense,
all right. It abrogates the covenant relationship, which involves God primarily, as the psalmist says in Psalm 51, against thee, thee only have I sinned. But God is concerned for his covenant people, as the last six commandments indicate in the Decalogue. And therefore, if you harm the covenant people, then you harm God and your relationship with God. But it violates covenant relationships. Actually, we've indicated that here. You cannot sin and maintain a covenant relationship with God, unless, of course, you engage in those rituals that provide atonement for sin. Okay, what else? Here. Yes, Brad? All right. Requires atonement. And can be atoned for, which means that sin is forgivable, as long as atonement is provided. Now, we have already talked about the question that's raised about high-handed sin, and that kind of sin is sin in which the individual raises a fist toward God and says, look, I don't care about you, God, I'm going to sin anyway. Whether that kind of sin could be atoned for is debatable in view of what we have in Numbers 15. But basically, the thrust here in any case, although I think even that sin could be atoned for, I think David's sin was somewhat of that sort. In any case, the emphasis in these rituals is that sin can be forgiven, which of course is the great hope that's provided by these rituals with regard to sin. What else is said about sin? Yes?
There are different types of sin.
All right. Try to capture that in some way. What different types in what sense?
Well,